Hello, and welcome to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies.
Welcome to the latest Oxford Institute for Energy Studies podcast. My name is David Ledesma, and I'm Distinguished Research Fellow at the Institute. It's my great pleasure to be joined today by Michael Maiden, who's Director of the Gas and China Programmes at the OIS, and David Sandelow, who's Distinguished Research Fellow at the OIS and also Inaugural Fellow at the Centre of Global Energy Studies Policy at Columbia University. Now, we're here today to discuss the key messages that came from their recently published book, Guide to Chinese Climate Policy 2022, which they co-authored with Dr. Philip Andrew Speed, Anders Hove, Sally Chu, and Edmund Downey, that was published by the OIS in November 2022. Now, just to timestamp this recording in an ever-changing world, we're recording this podcast on the afternoon of Monday, the 7th of November 2022, which is the first day of the COP27 conference. Michael and David, welcome to the OIS podcast series.
Great to be here, David.
David, thanks for having us.
Well, look, David, can I start with you? You know, can you perhaps tell us why you have been writing the guide, and why focus on China's climate policies? And also, you know, why does China matter?
David, last year, there were more greenhouse gas emissions from China than from the United States, Europe, and Japan combined. There is no solution to climate change without China. One thing I found from years of going to China and working on issues related to China is there's enormous misunderstanding about China in the West and a lack of reliable and authoritative information. And so our goal in the Guide to Chinese Climate Policy is to provide exactly that reliable and authoritative information about what's happening in China on this issue. I first did this book in 2018. I did a revision then in 2019. And hadn't revised it for 3 years. And this year, I was really honored to be joined by Michal and the other co-authors you mentioned. We turned it into a group project and released the book in November, as you said.
Yeah, I have to say, for those of you who haven't read it yet, it is free to download on the OIS website, or you can go to the Amazon website, and it really is absolutely fantastic. But building on, you mentioned the kind of, you did it in 2018 and 2019, and now again an update in 2022. So David, perhaps you could talk through some of the main differences between, let's say, 2019 and today.
Yeah, well, I'll first talk about the differences in policy, and then come the differences in the books. So first, most important, 2 years ago, President Xi Jinping of China announced a major important new goal for China, which is to achieve carbon neutrality by the year 2060. Today, the Chinese economy is overwhelmingly dependent on fossil fuels, like the rest of the world is. I think in the range of 56 to 57% of Chinese energy comes from coal. So to get to carbon neutrality implies a dramatic transformation in the Chinese economy over the course of the next several decades. That's a major policy announcement, and it's then been supplemented with the 14th five-year plan. China's had five-year plans every 5 years since the 1960s, and is the 14th, which was released over the course of the past year or so, contains literally dozens of goals related to this topic and dozens of objectives that help to implement this long-term goal of carbon neutrality. That said, and we talk about this in the guide, these are not necessarily the highest priority goals in China. So there's some tensions between this goal and other goals, and sometimes those other goals will often win out. Now, you asked about differences between the prior guide and the current guide. Let me also just say that in the current guide, the one that we just released, we added 8 new chapters on topics that I wasn't able to cover in prior guides. And we can come back and talk about those, but they include topics such as the hydrogen economy, such as the food system, such as manufacturing sector, and other issues that are really central to China's approach on climate change.
Well, Michal, can I turn to you? David's mentioned hydrogen, other kind of areas covered in the chapters. So what, in your view, were the kind of some of the issues that stood out in the guide? You know, let's maybe hydrogen and coal areas. What are your kind of what alerted you as you read it and wrote it?
Before we get to the new areas, which, building on what David has just said, the pledge has given a huge amount of impetus to the low carbon energy transition in China, and therefore there was a flurry of policies around some of these new areas. But coal, obviously the elephant in the room, I think the change of tone since 2019 was quite striking. I mean, back in that edition, David was discussing how coal consumption had peaked. And it had peaked in 2013, 2014, and was then sort of flatlining and even falling. The economy and industrial activity were slowing. And it was also sort of in part due to government policies to limit coal use. And we were really seeing the results of that. But then in the aftermath of COVID, with the kind of economic stimulus, there's been a sharp increase in coal consumption and demand. And actually, coal use in 2021 has exceeded the 2013-2014 peak coal, depending on the stats that you look at. But the trajectory certainly in 22 has been for another increase. This is all due to concerns about energy security, about the reliability of power supplies. But coal is very much in vogue in the policy discourse. Even if the growth in demand slowed somewhat this year, that change in debate and is interesting to note. In addition, there are some new chapters, including hydrogen, for instance. Now, of course, in 2019, hydrogen was a transport question for China. It wasn't really part of the, or it wasn't a major part of the low carbon transition as such. The focus had been on fuel cell vehicles as, again, part of transport solutions in China. And it's important to note here that China is the largest consumer and producer of hydrogen globally. As an aside, this is a theme that runs through this guide and other guides. China is the largest of lots of things in the world, but its hydrogen use is predominantly coal-based or black hydrogen. Since the 30-60 pledge, however, there has been a huge amount of momentum, both on the policy side and the industry level, on hydrogen. And that includes an encouragement to use hydrogen in more industries beyond sort of ammonia, methanol, and refining, which are the biggest users, but also to kind of enlarge the hydrogen rainbow, right, to use green hydrogen and other colors. And two interesting points to note here. First is that there is an interaction between policy and industry, with, in this case, industry sometimes getting ahead of policy, sort of knowing that there is going to be or assuming that there will be policy support, but actually it sometimes gets ahead of policy and leads to oversupply or duplication of efforts. Now, that means that some of these endeavors aren't necessarily the most economically efficient, but they do help to get new industries off the ground. Related to that, then, what we kind of notice or caution is that China's hydrogen hype could create new industrial capabilities, but it will not necessarily reduce China's carbon footprint if it continues to rely so heavily on coal. And we're seeing sort of similar issues in things like the emissions trading scheme, in that it does not yet impact China's emissions and certainly doesn't reduce China's emissions because it's nascent, because there are still numerous issues to iron out. But so that's just a slight taster of just to show just how many things are happening. Plenty of experiments, plenty of kind of policy support, and we do also try to think about how the industry is responding to some of that policy support.
Thank you, Mikael. Now, David, can I come back to you and actually ask you the same question? You know, what in your view were some of the kind of issues that stood out in writing the guide this time?
Well, Mikael was just pointing to industry, and we have a new chapter in the book on industrial emissions, which our colleague Ned Downey wrote, and it addresses a very important set of issues when it comes to greenhouse gas emissions in China. A very large percentage of China's emissions come from industry, from iron and steel, from cement, from chemical manufacturing. We get pretty deep into the statistics about how much. It really depends on how you count. But, you know, ballpark, we're talking 40 to 60% of Chinese emissions, depending on how you count, come from these industrial sources. So the decarbonization of China is really going to depend fundamentally on decarbonizing some of these industries. And that's a real challenge. They're often called hard to abate sectors. And there's some work that's going into this in China right now, but not nearly enough to get to carbon neutrality. And it's going to require innovation and technologies and probably the use of carbon capture and storage and more. So that's one issue. Another issue that we point to, which I think gets much too little attention, is the food system. And globally, the food system accounts for 30% of emissions of greenhouse gases, 30%. And I find many people that work on climate policy are not even aware of this. And in one sense, it's not surprising. Every human being on the planet, you know, eats every day. And so a lot of our activities relate to the food system. But in China, food system is a major contributor to greenhouse gas emissions, like in every other country. And we look at exactly where those emissions are coming from and what policies are in place in order to address it. You know, in China, for many years, the so-called number one policy document, the first policy document released every year, is on the food system. Food is, you know, incredibly important. Food security is incredibly important in China. And for the first time in the past several years, Chinese policymakers are aligning some of their policies on the food system with their policies on climate change. One interesting example of this is the Clean Plates campaign, which President Xi Jinping personally has been pushing, which is to reduce the amount of food waste in China. Food waste has been kind of a cultural feature of some aspects of, you know, Chinese life. And President Xi is trying to end that. And there are even fines now in some Chinese restaurants if you leave food on your plate. So that in turn has an impact on climate change by reducing the amount of food waste in the system and the amount of emissions that come from the food system. So many more examples, but I think both manufacturing system and food system are two really important areas that we pay attention to in this book.
It amazes me whenever we talk about China, all the numbers are large, but you know, that overall number of 30% food waste, you know, it really is quite stunning, I have to say, and something we should all bear in mind. Well, look, Mika, can I come to you? And perhaps can we talk for a few minutes about the party congress that took place? That's the 20th Party Congress in October 2022, because President Xi talked about building the new before breaking the old. So now, how should we think about China's commitment to tackling climate change, given the trends in coal consumption? You know, is China serious, do you think?
And we have just talked about coal and its significance and changing narrative. Now, these statements are not new to the 20th Party Congress. The emphasis on the need for supplies, reliable and secure supplies, is mentioned in the 14th Five-Year Plan as well. Much of these concerns stem from international elements, but also domestic issues. China's power crunch last year, as well as price volatility in the aftermath of the Russian invasion of Ukraine. The fact remains that both national and regional level, there is a desire for stability through coal. But that does not mean that China isn't making huge gains in renewables. We tend to see a lot of press about coal. But again, there is a lot happening on the renewable side. And there are a number of chapters about renewables, specifically in power sector reform, that Anders Hovey wrote. We've just talked about China being the largest in many areas. This is relevant for renewables, too. China alone has three times as much renewable capacity as any other country had in 2021. And 43% of renewable capacity added globally was in China. Size matters. But despite these huge gains, wind and solar accounted for only 12% of power generation. So a lot of government support, subsidies, some are being phased out and fine-tuned, but also local government initiatives that are documented and that we follow in the book do suggest that China is well on track to meeting many of its renewables target, including one that has been highly talked about, with China wanting to reach 1,200 gigawatts of installed wind and solar capacity by 2030. With all the announcements and everything that's happening, it's actually well on track to meet that by the mid-2020s, so 5 years ahead of time, essentially. But so the 20th Party Congress, when it talks about sort of building the new but keeping the old, talks about that, but it does also reiterate the kind of government's approach to and all of the above energy policy. Renewables are clearly set to grow rapidly, but everything else, sort of there's nuclear, there's hydropower, and it's very much a system-wide approach. And I think that is important to bear in mind. We often look at these documents and sort of look for the numbers, right? What are the headline targets and what are the headline numbers? And actually what's been happening in the 14th five-year plan and in this is that the thinking is very much about systems, power, energy systems, and their resilience. For now, unfortunately, coal is a bit like a blankie that provides comfort about reliability. But there is clearly a broader thinking about how to set up a decarbonized energy system in which renewables will be a central part.
Okay, now the guide discusses lots of policy issues, you know, both domestic and international, and it seems like, you know, there are kind of competing or even contradictory elements here. So, Mikhail, can you perhaps talk about some of your key takeaways from reviewing all of these policies?
I think the first thing to note is that despite lots of moving parts, and as David likes to say, a study in contrast that is Chinese climate policy, it is important to note that the commitment is very real, and Xi Jinping's pledge to reach net zero by 2060 has elevated the low carbon transition on the policy agenda. It has shaped and framed the way that various governments, but also industry bodies and corporate actors, think about China's energy system. And this has led to numerous policy documents, again, on all kind of levels, central government, provincial governments, industrial bodies, all trying to figure out a way to get there. And this is very similar to what's happening in the West. We don't know what the technologies, kind of which technologies will be available and at what costs. I don't think any country has a very clear blueprint on how to get there, but the direction of travel has been set, and I think that is significant and is very important to bear in mind.
Okay, David, that perhaps can come back to you, because if that's the case, you know, how can you explain things like, you know, massive new approvals of coal-fired power plants and indeed policy reversal on oil product export quotas, which, you know, seems to be complicating, if not hindering, the 2060 pledge?
You know, I pointed to this earlier, David. Climate change mitigation is a goal of the Chinese government. It's a genuine goal. You know, in contrast to my country, the United States, there are no known climate deniers in the Chinese government. So they mean it when they say they're working towards carbon neutrality. But there are other goals, and those other goals have tended to take priority. Certainly, COVID control has taken priority over everything the past year or two in China. Energy security, as Mikhail was pointing to, has been a priority, and economic growth is always a priority. So I think that's one important factor. You know, a little bit more technically, from an energy policy standpoint, in terms of the coal plant approvals, when Chinese energy planners are asked about the coal plant approvals, what they often say is, we need coal to balance our renewable energy, that we're massively scaling up solar and wind power, but the sun doesn't always shine, the wind doesn't always blow. In your country, they'll tell me, you've got natural gas to balance those renewables when the sun isn't shining, the wind isn't blowing. But we don't have ample domestic resources of natural gas, we have coal. And so we're going to use our coal plants and run them at low capacity, but use them to balance coal. I think around the world, there's some skepticism that once you build these enormous coal-fired power plants, they'll be run at very low capacity in the decades ahead. But that's what Chinese energy planners are saying right now.
Yeah, and it's also a matter of size. We've talked about that earlier on, isn't it? You've got to build a lot of power stations to have the backup. Is that the case?
Well, you know, there are other strategies for backup, and that's an important dialogue. I mean, reform of power markets, building more transmission capacity, you know, to trade electricity among different parts of the country, can both of those and other measures can reduce the need for this type of backup. Oh, and of course, investing in energy storage like batteries or, you know, other types of measures. So all of those can reduce the need for coal-fired power plants as backup. But right now, that's a backup the Chinese energy planners feel that they need.
Well, Mikhail, can I come back to you, you know, and really perhaps ask a difficult question, you know? How can you be confident that China will actually meet its climate goals, therefore?
I think the main reason that I'm cautiously optimistic is that China's climate policy sort of aligns with a number of other priorities. And coal is a huge question mark, it is a huge problem. And, you know, there's not that much discussion about stranded assets that could be created in the future by building new coal-fired capacity that will, as David just said, operate at whatever, 20%. And yet at the same time, the Chinese are quick to point out that their existing coal fleet is only 12 to 15 years old, and therefore you can't phase it out very quickly. Coal is a problem, but beyond coal, sort of creating winners is something that China has historically been good at. And as I said, a low carbon energy transition aligns with a number of policy priorities. First and foremost, China's industrial policies to lead the industries of the future. And China is already dominant in manufacturing, not just the deployment of renewable energy, batteries, electric vehicles. It is making huge investments in hydrogen, as we were just discussing. So it is an industrial policy, and I think that's something that we're starting to see in the US with the Inflation Reductions Act, that this is, you know, becoming a bit more widespread. But also it dovetails with energy security, as we've just been discussing. I mean, electrification will help China to reduce its reliance on oil and gas. Now, of course, for it to be a solution to the low carbon transition, we have to decarbonize the power sector. But electrification in itself does help energy security. It coincides with food security, just as David was talking about food systems that, have been elevated in the policy discussion. All of these priorities converge, including some of the kind of international aspects, sort of multilateral diplomacy, China's position as a leader of the developing world in the COP negotiations. All of these things mean that China has an interest, a domestic interest, regardless of what happens in the US or at COP27, to pursue its low carbon transition. And despite sort of short-term changes in the policy priority sort of list in that time frame, over time, that is still the direction of travel that makes sense for China.
Well, David, can I perhaps come to you, you know, for the last question in this podcast? Because as I said earlier on, we're recording it actually on the first day of the COP27 conference in Sharm el-Sheikh. So perhaps, you know, you could share with us your view on what we can expect from China at the conference and maybe on the prospects for US-China climate collaboration.
Chinese delegation will be at Sharm el-Sheikh in force. China has had a large and growing delegation participating in these negotiations for years now. Minister Xie Zhenhua, the head of the delegation, is one of the most expert and sophisticated negotiators globally right now on these issues. And the Chinese delegation will be emphasizing the steps that the Chinese government's taking right now to address climate change, including the big investment in renewables that Macau was talking about, China's work on electric vehicles, work on forestry, work around the world, which we haven't had a chance to touch on right now, but it's a topic we touch on in the book, but work with partner countries on promoting renewables there as well. So I think the Chinese delegation will be talking about all these things. You asked about U.S.-China rapprochement. As of today, there are no public signs of any rapprochement between the U.S. and China on climate change issues. The status is that, I mean, U.S. and the quick history is that U.S. and China working together has been a very important force in moving multilateral negotiations forward. A year before the Paris Agreement, President Obama and President Xi Jinping reached an accord that I think laid an important foundation for the Paris Agreement. That was picked up; those talks were picked up during the beginning of the Biden administration, but then about 3 or 4 months ago now were broken off in a dispute over Taiwan-related issues. As of today, there's no sign no public statements with respect to any resumptions of those talks. I certainly hope that our two countries can get back to working together on climate change issues, whatever our differences on other issues, because it's been a very important force in moving the world forward on climate change in the past.
But certainly, you know, the images we saw from COP26 at Glasgow of the US and the Chinese delegation actually working together at the conference were quite key to some of the kind of announcements at the end of COP26. You know, could we see the same again, do you think, David?
That would be tremendous if we did, no question.
I agree with you. Well, you know, Mikhail and David, you know, thank you so much for your time. You know, I really enjoyed the conversation that builds on the messages from your book, The Guide to Chinese Climate Policy 2022, that was published by the OIS in November 2022. Now, this podcast is only, 25 minutes long, and the book is very extensive. So you can download it at the OIS website, as I said earlier on, or you can go onto Amazon and get it from there. Please do. It is a great read. Now, I urge you all also to watch out for additional papers and podcasts around the China climate policy, which you'll be able to see on the OIS website over the coming months. So I hope you've all enjoyed listening to this podcast. Thank you and goodbye to everyone.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies. You can find other podcasts, as well as our original research, on our website at www.oxfordenergy.org. If you would like more details about our energy transition, gas, oil, electricity, or China research programs, then please contact us at information@oxfordenergy.org.